Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book, In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 8.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Yeah, I think it's just me, so I think we can start it whenever.
Consequence Podcast Network.
And welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thank you, as always, for making your way here, for checking out the episode. Hit that subscribe button while you're hanging around. That way, you get three brand new interviews sent to you every single week. New one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. It's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover some new ones. You can grab us at Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcast from. Subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Also, please do give the show a rating. Leave a review if you feel so inspired. It always helps. We've had some great guests on lately, including comedian Matt Matthews, Prentice Penny from Black Twitter, the documentary series on Hulu. Spike Ferenston, he co-wrote Unfrosted with Jerry Seinfeld. That movie's out now on Netflix. We spoke with Brent Smith of Shinedown. Sarah Dowlin, the documentarian behind Sue Bird in the Clutch. Katie Crutchfield from Waxahachie was here. Kevin Bacon and the Bacon Brothers. Actor Scoot McNairy, he stars in Blood for Dust opposite Kit Harington. Mike McCready and Stone Gossard of Pearl Jam. Dave Wakeling of the English Beat. Skeet Ulrich from Scream. And Riverdale. Beth Ditto from Gossip. Just an example of what you get when you subscribe to the Kyle Meredith With podcast. And that's me, Kyle Meredith, today talking with David Miller of Il Divo. They're back with a new record, XX or Double X or 20. It's two X's next to each other anyway. And so we're going to be talking about how the album comes on the 20th anniversary of the group and features covers of artists such as Whitney Houston, Gnarls Barkley, Willie Nelson. David's going to tell us about going independent after parting ways with Simon Cowell, losing founding member Carlos Marin to COVID, and how the record connects to their earliest work. David then's going to discuss the new vocal tools he's acquired over the years, what it's like to continue to hit the highest of notes that he hits as a tenor, and the story behind the album's lone original song. Let's get into this. We're talking XX. It's Kyle Meredith with David Miller of Il Divo.
Hello.
This also marks your all's first independent album, is that right?
Yes, yes. This is the first album that's on our own label.
So what has that meant? I mean, has it been a big change just to how things work?
It's been a big change in terms of our learning curve about how the music industry, how all of the pieces that an actual record company brings to the table and how important all of those pieces are and how expensive all of those pieces are. And, you know, footing the bill for the entire thing was a massive undertaking for us. And we kind of had an interesting transition to get here because we were with Sony and Psycho, Simon Cowell's label in the UK, and distributed by Sony kind of worldwide for over a decade. And we kind of paid attention here and there. We kind of asked questions, you know, just out of curiosity at the time. And then we came to a moment where Creatively, it wasn't that there were differences in the creative direction of how we wanted to proceed, but there were other priorities for Simon that came up, namely his TV shows that required so much of his attention 24/7, basically, that the momentum around and the prioritization around his recording artists had waned a little bit. And we were still champing at the bit, wanting to keep going. And so we pitched him an idea for an album that they passed on. And we said, okay, well, what do you guys want to do for an album? And they said, we don't have any ideas yet. So we asked them, after a certain period of time, like kind of a grace period around it, where they still didn't have a concept for us, we said, look, we have loved being partners with you on this, but we have a lot that we still want to accomplish. Can we go and do that? And very amicably, super gentlemanly, Simon said yes. And they gave us the rights to our name. And we set about trying to put all the pieces in place. This was in 2015, put all the pieces in place to create an album of our own. And at the time, we didn't really have the balls, as Carlos would have said. We didn't have the huevos to fully take on the mantle ourselves. So we partnered with Universal, and they produced the Timeless album. Well, they funded the Timeless album. And we went through all of the production process with our producer, Alberto Quintero, in Spain. We gave them the songs. We worked with the arrangers, kind of got the arrangements. We kind of dabbled in it, dabbled in it, dabbled in it. And that was in 2015. Then we had the Motown album that was supposed to come out in 2020, but then COVID. So that got postponed and kind of came out in 2021, 2020. Yeah, it was 2021. And we had kind of done the same process with that. But then there was COVID, and that kind of everything kind of gummed up all the process. And then we lost Carlos to COVID, and everything just kind of fell apart for, the majority of 2 years. And when we kind of came out the other side through doing a New Day tour in 2022, 2023, we thought, oh crap. Next year's our 20th anniversary. It all just kind of like hit us like a ton of bricks. And so we thought, you know what? It is a new day. It is the 20th anniversary. We've basically done this twice already and had success with it. Let's bite the bullet. Let's just make this our own and, pay for it ourselves and pull up our big boy pants and see what we can create. And this is what we made.
And we'll be right back right after this.
Saving money on remodeling your home Menards. Start your tile project off right with DentShield Tile Backer from Georgia-Pacific. It's proven to protect against moisture in your walls and subfloors, with a built-in water barrier, making it perfect to use in damp areas like kitchens and bathrooms. Plus, its easy-to-cut design makes installation a breeze. Save big on Georgia-Pacific DentShield Tile Backer panels. On sale through March 2nd. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals. Save big.
Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with David Miller of Il Divo.
And it's a fun record. It's a beautiful record.
Thank you.
You'd mentioned looking for a concept. Was that the same when you went into this? Because obviously this is a 20th record. Is it a record that has to speak for 20 years? Were you looking for something more specific?
That's a good question. Well, we had gone through the first album in 2004. Was basically just an experiment. Nobody knew what was going to happen. Simon didn't know. We didn't know. It took Simon. Simon wanted it to be a TV show, actually, putting together the band. And it was this massive kind of cattle call situation at the very beginning. And he was not getting the caliber of voices that he was looking for. He had this idea in his mind. He loved the three tenors. He loved Andrea Bocelli. He liked classical voice, but thought that classical voice was not being utilized in a popular way. So how can we do that? So let's make a boy band and let's turn it into a TV show. Well, people of the type of voices he was looking for, we just didn't show up to that because by this point in this stage in our careers, we have agencies that are, you know, bespokely tailoring auditions for us where, you know, it's maybe, you know, me against like two or three other guys up for, you know, playing Rodolfo in La Boheme, yeah, at X opera company, whatever. You get to a certain point in your career where it actually damages you to show up to cattle calls and things like that in terms of your opera career. And none of us were really thinking, oh, I'm going to go join a boy band and I'm going to be a recording artist. In the opera world, if you are lucky enough to get a recording contract, you might record an album of arias, or you might do a cast recording of an opera with a great conductor. They put it on the shelves. They say, thank you very much. You get paid, you go back to your career. This was a completely different, conceptually, something for an opera singer to do. So Carlos was the first one. He was invited to the band. I know this is a very long story. I'm very long-winded. You got the big stories guy.
Yeah, luckily, podcasts, that's what people expect. So have at it.
Oh, good. And so Carlos went to this first cattle call audition, and he almost left. He called his agent up, and he was like, what am I doing here? There are 150, 200 people here. This is ridiculous. I'm leaving. And his agent convinced him to stay and said, look, I don't know what this is, but this could be really interesting for your career. Just stick it out, see what happens. So he did. And he met Simon. He didn't know who Simon was because this was in 2004. The TV shows were just barely taken off at that point. Being from Spain, where they didn't have Idol yet, he didn't know this guy from Adam. So he's just speaking to him frankly, basically told him what I told you. You want voices like mine, you need to do this differently. You need to go to opera agencies. You need to get agents to get you bespoke. So it changed Simon's concept completely of what it was going to be. And he started going on the hunt through opera agencies. And I think it took him 2 years to find all of us. And I think it was like 17 different countries that they were doing auditions. And so they put the four of us in a room. Finally, in the recording studio was when we actually met each other, and they gave us a bunch of songs. And they said, what can you do with this? Here's the concept, pitched us the concept and said, you guys are the voices. What would you do with this? And kind of gave us carte blanche creatively to explore our voices. Because as an opera singer, you kind of have one gear. You have your opera gear, and that's sing to the back of the house. It's a different animal to do recordings and to use your voice with the mic right here. So you can get, you know, less projecty with your voice, and you can get super intimate. So it was a huge discovery process of discovering which colors of our voices worked in which parts of the song, whose voice fit best in each part of the song. And I remember we recorded every song for that first album. Each one of us, of the four of us, recorded the whole song front to back. And the producers chopped it up and said, I'll take your part from here and your part from here. Also, we didn't know which language was going to work. Simon wanted it to be this exotic thing where we take pop songs and make it feel European. So we tried every song in English, Spanish, Italian, and French. So we had four languages and four singers. We had 16 different versions of this song for 10 songs. So we had 160 versions of that first album that are out there that they chopped and spliced up. Massive grand experiment that took 4 months to record that album. It was unheard of. And so we did that one. We released it. It had success. So of course, as a record company will do, they're like, snapshot, do that.
Do it again.
Do it again. So we did it again. Captured lightning in a bottle a second time. So they said, do it again. Captured lightning in a bottle a third time. It's still growing. We're on the Oprah Winfrey Show. We're on Jay Leno. It's going gangbusters. And then the record company says, do it again. Mm-hmm. And at this point, that trilogy kind of ran out of steam of the format. Mm-hmm. So we did the format again in the next album was The Promise. It's okay. Simultaneously, streaming is starting to come in, Napster is starting to come in, social media is starting to come in, YouTube is now a thing. So sales are not doing as well. Still good. I think it's a great album. But at this point, they start asking the question, What, if you had to say in one word, what is the one thing that makes Il Divo successful? What is it? Go. And each one of us had a different word, completely different word.
Sure.
One was said, the power of the voices. One said the emotional heart-rendingness of it. Once, you know, everyone just went meh and pointed to a different thing. And we all went, okay, well, that doesn't help. So we did The Promise. Then the next one was the Wicked Game album. And they kept trying to distill it down. And every time they did that and they whittled it down, the album was somehow not, well, I've always described Il Divo as a juggling act or a musical juggling act. A little bit of him, a little bit of him, switch gears, a little bit of him. It's in Spanish, it's in Italian. It's like this all the time. And you never know where each song is going to end up. Sometimes it ends big, sometimes it ends intimately. And every time they tried to just compartmentalize it and figure out how to use that very, because it's an expensive process. We have to record a 70-piece orchestra. You know, we have to have arrangers. We have to have producers. We, the four of us flying us here and there just to get to the recording studio, putting us up. You know, it's a massive undertaking. So they want value for their money. They're trying to distill it down. Finally, we get to the point where it's like, okay, this variety act thing doesn't seem to be working. And I'm like, is it because people aren't buying albums? Like, no, no, we've lost the magic. We need to find the magic. Let's create a concept. So we went with a musical theater album where we did all musical theater. And I would say commercially, that was our worst album. It did not land. And a lot of that album was in English. A lot of it was very traditionally kind of faithful to music theater. Il Divo stepped outside of its center and went to a genre. Didn't really work. So we released the Greatest Hits album after that, which was a repackaging of other songs and a couple new tracks. And that did very well. So it was like, all right, well, let's do another concept album and see how that does, just to test the waters. We did the Amor y Pasión album, which was all Latino music, but from different genres, and boleros and rumbas and tangos and this and that. So there's still some variety. And people loved it, especially the Latin America market, South America, Central America, they loved it. Rest of the world didn't quite get it. The US, Canada, UK, Japan, arguably our four biggest single territory markets. And that was when it was like, the record company was like, well, we don't know what to do. So we went back to the drawing board sort of with Timeless. And then we went to the concept album with the Motown. Mm-hmm. So that big long story to say, what we decided to do with Double X was to go back to that first discovery process. Go back to that first, pretend we don't know anything. Pretend Il Divo never existed. Very difficult to do. It was like an acting exercise. If Simon were to do this today with no knowledge of previous conception, what would he do? And it was like, okay, well, we analyzed that first album. We said, well, we had multiple producers. We had Swedish producers. We had English producers. We had different arrangers. It was kind of this hodgepodge. Okay, so let's somehow create a hodgepodge. Let's go back to the juggling idea. We go back to the different languages. We go back to exploring whose voice goes where, because also we have a new member. We have Stephen LaBrie. And so his contribution musically, his musical impulses, you know, he is a baritone and kind of completes the model of Il Divo, but he has different musical impulses, which adjusts our musical impulses as we play off of each other. And we basically had been at it from kind of concept to finish. We'd been at it for like 6 months to really just rediscover the unpredictability in a way, the exploration in a way, being willing to kind of not fall into the, well, this is where David usually sings, so put him there. Well, it was like, all right, we'll try it with him. Try it with him. And so that was the thing with this album, to really, you know, do we try and make things sound modern? Because in all actuality, in 2004, it all sounds kind of dated at this point and kind of like classical Diabo style. But at the time, we were using the producers that Westlife were using. We were using the producers that Britney Spears were using, was using. And we were kind of where pop music was at the time. And for like 18 years, we kind of stayed in 2004. So Sebastian also got involved because he's a producer. He's produced two of his own albums. And he was like, I want to be kind of co-producing with this and working on the arrangements. And I really think we need to bring it into the 2020s. And so it was a huge dissection process of, you know, and learning how complicated it is for a record company and their thought process, because so many times it was like, well, what did we do there? And how did that work? And then trying to point fingers and going like, that's what the record company kept doing. We need to not do that. Okay. Forget that. Let's try again.
It's really interesting to hear, like, for any group, band, artist, whatever, that has longevity, I think they all eventually get to this point. You know, like, we've experimented, we've taken the roads. Now what happens if we bring it back in? Like, the way to move forward is to go back to where you started. And, you know, with changes. I mean, obviously, you're I would imagine you've got more tools in your vocal belt these days.
Almost too many. No, it's true, because there's, like I was saying before, that the opera gear is kind of an opera singer's go-to. You really don't stray beyond that window of approach. You might be louder, you might be softer, but you're right in your core all the time, and you sound like Julia Childs all the time. And that's who you are as a classical singer. And that's kind of why everyone thinks we have our heads up our own butts, because we sound so pompous and pretentious. You don't step outside that. You don't get into the raw pop, the raw emotive power of the voice. We kind of cover it up with technique and layers and technique and study and practice. And it's kind of drummed out of us, that kind of raw sound that is part of the human experience of voice. And you find that in the recording studio. And then you do that a few times and you explore further and explore further and explore further. And then you go on tour. And then you get into the marathon of doing all of these new colors that you've just explored. You've gone from, you know, having the 8-box Crayola to the 256 Crayola box. And now you have to draw every single day and use those crayons. And those crayons get rubbed. I'm loving this analogy. I don't know where it's coming from. But those crayons get rubbed down real quick till you're like almost at the nubs. And it's like you start to run out of the shimmer, I would call it, because you're tired. Then you have to figure out compensation techniques. How can I continue to deliver this performance 100% when I don't feel 100%? Then you start, that's a whole other box of crayons. Then you get stuck in and out of patterns of being tired and not being tired. And you've been tired for so long that then you're not tired, but you're using the tired crayons and you're creating bad habits. It's such a crazy process. Then you go back in the studio and you're like, I have a million crayons. Which one do I use?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess I should say, to compliment you, to say it's amazing that you came out with anything after hearing all of that. That sounds like this. So far, it's like madness, you know, but, you know, that's where the talent comes in. And that's, you know, that's what I think about with a lot of songwriters. I mean, as you go along, you know, it's just collecting more and more tools that you're able to use. You know, why was Prince able to write as many things? Like, cause he learned every melody in the world on every instrument in the world, you know, and the same with Paul McCartney, any of that stuff, you know, it's just knowing that stuff.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with David Miller of Il Divo.
You have the songs. And the songs coming sometimes from the pop world. How much does that give you access past what, you know, opera fans might expect? Like, as you were saying, you know, you've got the 8 crayon box. Yeah, but if you're doing Gnarls Barkley's Crazy, if you're doing Whitney Houston's I Have Nothing, like, I would imagine that gives you a lot of leeway to go past that with grace.
That's a very interesting point. I think the blessing and the curse of it is exactly what you said, is that taking these songs that are radically disparate and trying to incorporate them in the Il Divo universe, you do have latitude because there is an expectation you're going to do something different. Then you have to figure out what to do with these mammoth pieces and how will they translate into the classical voice. And you have to find that in a relatively short period of time, because recording is expensive, but you have to honor, first of all, you have to honor your voice. Secondly, you have to honor the piece. Thirdly, you have to honor the template of the sound you're trying to create. There is leeway, there is experimentation, but what we're really known for is kind of the gear, the Il Divo gear that it kicks into, which is, you know, you could argue is operatic, but I would argue it goes beyond opera from the standpoint of in opera, you start the show, one person comes out, they sing an aria, maybe another person comes out, they sing a duet, they leave, new scene, someone else comes out, maybe they leave, maybe three people come out, four people come out, they leave, you come back out, you sing another song, duet, chorus, finale of an act, act one. You're maybe on stage in an opera, maybe 30 to 40 minutes. If you're a feature, if you're like the principal or the title role, you might get like 50 or 60 minutes across a 2-hour show. And within those moments of singing, you go through a range of emotions and you usually have a high note at the end and then you leave. Il Divo does that every 4 minutes.
Right.
Every 4 minutes is an operatic finale. It's, yes, it's pop music, but we have put it in that gear. And I sing in any Il Divo show because every song, for me, being the highest voice, ends either on a B flat, B natural, C, or C sharp, in some cases D, and in one case E flat above high C. We don't do that song very much anymore. Because it's just going up there, even just like pinging off of that. It's a song called I Believe in You, which was a duet with, my brain just went dead. Celine Dion, a duet with her, but on tour, she's not coming on tour with us. So I take Celine Dion's part. So I smack up to that E flat and it's just for a second. But that having to go into that section of my voice reconfigures singing high C sustain. We do this every 4 minutes for 90 minutes. It is harder than any opera I have ever sung, and you never leave the stage every night for 5 nights a week. It's insane. So, you know, it's when we take an individual song and we're trying to translate that into our voices, we're now at the point where we're like, well, maybe we can take it down a half step because this is going to kill David. Maybe we don't make it a 16-second fermata sustain high C. Maybe we make it 12. And we try and find ways that's not going to kill David. Simultaneously, we have to go back to honoring the song. When the song has a pulse and a feel and it's got that grandiosity, and it's like, if we lose those 4 seconds, it's kind of going to cheapen the moment. So it's like, all right, here we go. Pull the pants up. And like, really, I have to do it because and this is the curse, the blessing and the curse is the blessing is we can do it. The curse is we have to do it. There's no getting around it.
Yeah. The expectations.
Yeah.
You set the bar. You set the bar yourself, but everyone went, that's it. We all agree.
And
we're
with
all here
every
for that.
Album, and with every album, the bar gets higher. Oof. Because
as you get older, by the way, that's
get older. Like, yeah. I just celebrated my 50th birthday this year, and I don't feel like I'm slowing down, but like I got COVID a few times last year, and I know it hits people hard, and I know that it there's the long COVID thing and stuff like that, and it's got knock on effects, which I did have. I don't want to attribute that to age, but I know that that's part of it. I know that I am 50 something because everyone keeps telling me that. And I'm trying to like, you're only as old as you feel, but you can't escape the grays that are there. You can't escape all of the signs that threaten to undermine your psyche all the time, you gotta pull those crayons out too.
On top of all that, so I want to work back around to the song, because the songs, because now that you've kind of put in place everything about this, it's also the first time that you all wrote one of your own for the album.
Yes.
And to say that it has to have all of this, but now it's on you all. Now you can't crutch on the song, right? Like, right. What was that process, and how much of that weighed on you?
This has to be, in 20 years of being an Il Divo, the silliest thing we've ever done. Part of the analysis of the first album was that at least half the songs was original material. And Sebastian does write music. He writes pop music. I'm a composer, a classical composer. I don't have any works out there, but I went to classical conservatory. I took composition. I understand music and theory and voice leading and all of that. I play piano. I play piano, cello, trombone, guitar, bass guitar. It's kind of like you were alluding to Prince. Because for me, the wider a framework of knowing how a melody works within different contexts for a single note instrument of a violin, you know, they play one note, maybe two, three, kind of is their max if they're like beyond virtuosic. Trombone, one note at a time. Guitar, it's chords. Piano, it's chords, and it's also melodic. Piano has the access for 10 voice leadings all at once. It's arguably the most complicated thing you can do musically, other than bandoneon, which I play that too. But I don't say this to like build myself up. It's more to say like my understanding of like voice leading and harmonics is very rooted in the classical approach of what one of our producers would call the journey away from home and the journey home. So every melody has a starting point. It kind of goes da 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 da, and it ends back up at home. And the more complicated you can make that, or the more interesting you can make that, melodically, the notes are all the same. You have to then figure out instrumentation. You have to figure out structure, arrangement, how one instrument passes the ball to another. And this is all absent of the voice. This is just, you know, the packaging. So Sebastian does more pop elements where it's like, you know, K-I-S-S, keep it simple, stupid. It's like, it's all about the voice, and everything else is kind of, you know, you've got the four chords, six if you're lucky, if you know how to work with them, more if you're more interesting. And so the two of us start noodling. And it's like, okay, we kind of have this idea of, and we had taken two examples of, we wanted to take a Schubert piece, a Schubert Ständchen, what was the other one? It wasn't Barber's Adagio. It was, can't remember, some other classical piece. Take these classical pieces, take their harmonic underpinnings, write different melodies over top, see what we come up with. We came up with radically different things that we then tried to fuse and overlap, take that final hybrid melody, wipe away all the underpinnings, and create something new underpinnings underneath. Now you've got a whole new Rubik's Cube of song. We pitched it to the other two guys, and they both went, this sounds like Schubert's Ständchen and the other thing, but not as good. So we both went, wah, wah. So I was like, all right, try again. So we started, Seb came up with a piece that kind of had a unique feel. I had come up with something on my own. We tried to take pieces of his for the verses and pieces of mine for the chorus. I've never written with someone before. For me, composition is not a collaborative effort. For me, composition is an expression of something that's bubbling up out of one's soul. I've never looked at it from a commercial standpoint, and I've never collaborated before. So this is all something new for me. He's collaborated with loads of people before. He's able to take his ego out of it and say, what serves the song? For me, the song is a reflection of me. Right. So it's very narcissistic from that standpoint of like, it's more like, how do I serve myself? How do I make this thing that maybe it's something I want to sing, or something I want people to feel or whatever, because I'm feeling something. It's very much a mirror process for me. So we're like trying this and that, and then we're on Zoom calls. We're working with our producer, Carlos Lopez. He's a third writer who's involved helping us, like, and he's really like, I know about the harmonies and voice leading, but you know, he's got like a doctorate in it. So he's taking things and kind of, well, I hear you saying this and I hear you saying this. Are you both kind of saying this? Yeah, that's good. And it was just this process of like, push me, pull you, trying stuff. Mm-hmm. That in the middle of trying to figure out all the other songs and all the other arrangements that Seb is co-producing with Carlos Lopez, that are all definitely the priority. The boys said, if you guys come up with something interesting that we like enough to put it on the album, that they will stand up with these other songs, we'll do it. Otherwise, here's the other 10th song. And we have to have that arrangement built as well in case your guys' song doesn't work. No pressure. So, and that other song was Foray's A Présent Rêve. So we just kept chipping away at it, played them demo pieces, 16 bars of like, here's kind of a verse and a chorus. What do you think? And it was enough to capture their imaginations. And they're like, all right, we're going to trust you guys on this. This is the 10th song. We're going to lose A Présent Rêve because we don't have the time to create both arrangements. We get into recording, we're still not finished. We get all the way up to the day of the recordings. The last recording day is for that because we just didn't have it ready. We wrote the bridge section, or the middle eight, I don't remember what you call it in pop music, which is which, between the second chorus and the third chorus. And we wrote that in the morning as the boys were headed in to record that afternoon. And they got there and we still weren't finished. So we asked them, we're like, well, if this isn't working, what would you guys do? It was such a mishmash and such a silly experience. And people love it. People have given us like such great feedback on this song, which was, in all actuality, just kind of a sum up of everything we went through for that first album, this just grand experiment of like, all right, let's throw it against the wall, see what sticks. It kind of encapsulates that, this song encapsulates in 2 minutes and 30 seconds, because in case we needed to make a TV edit, we didn't want to have to pare it down. So we made the actual song be TV edit length. For me, it's too short. I think it's truncated. I have my big opinions about this. We all kind of have opinions about this, but the people are loving it, and that's what matters.
Yeah, that's people think, you know, their favorite songs just are like blipped into existence, like, yeah, boom, and then, yeah, you hear the stories behind it, and it's the, like, I've heard this story, you know, before, and it's also, I understand now why there's only one original song on the album. That's
well, there was only space for one. Now that we've done it and we have, you know, I'm happy to like weigh in on something rather than go through this, like, because there's like two songs in their entirety that I wrote as we were kind of like pitching ideas that Seb was like, yeah, I don't get it. And there were songs that he wrote that I'm like, yeah, I don't get it. But he does this all the time. He churns them out. I write two songs and this is like, you know, 3 months of my life that I get really attached to the outcome, and to have someone say, I don't get it. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you know, I can appreciate you don't get it, but I don't want to spend 3 months of my life to just be like, all right, garbage can. So how much I might be involved going forward, I don't know. I might just be in it for the making the classical arrangements, because I really enjoy that.
I'm really glad you guys went through the struggle of this, because it did pay off. And I can say that about so many of the songs on it. You know, the pop songs, you've made them new again, and that's always important. But the fact that you guys, you know, have found ways to continue to make this interesting, not just for us, but for yourselves, I know that's important as well.
It also gets more difficult with every album. The amount of repertoire out there to choose from, we go through this huge process where we sift through, I don't know, like 150, 200 songs to make the short list, to make the 10 song list. So all the songs we've said no to are kind of like, we've kind of checked them off. Like, it either doesn't work melodically, it doesn't work dramatically, it doesn't work for whatever reason. We've kind of checked these songs off. And
so you can't go back.
I mean, we can, but the number of songs that kind of tick all the Il Divo boxes of like the melody kind of has to do this. It can't just do this. It has to go somewhere harmonically. It can't just be something that jumps all over because we have to stack our voices. It's got to have emotional drama. It's got to be romantic. It's got to be, it's not going to be something bubblegum. That's not going to make sense for us. It has to have depth and character and somewhere for our voices to sink into. And that number of songs that are out there that we're currently aware of, I know there's loads of music that none of us know we don't know, but the songs that we do know are kind of running out.
You know what? I've got faith in you all because you've figured out how to do it over and over again. So, in the meantime, double X, XX, 20, I've called it everything, I think, at this point. I'm really excited that you all do continue to do this. And David, seriously, it was so nice talking to you about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on the show.
My thanks to David. The new Il Divo record, XX, is out now. And thanks to you for checking out the episode. Again, please do hit that subscribe button while you're here. That way you get three new interviews just like this one sent to you every single week. It's a new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. It's Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcast from, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. And also, yeah, please give the series a rating. Wherever you're listening, a review if you feel so inspired, that always helps. After that, head over to WFPK.org. It's where I do a show Monday through Friday starting at 6 p.m. Eastern. You get 4 hours of classics from the 80s and 90s. You get the best in new music. There are bonus interviews, lots of music news as well. One of my recent shows featured some classics and favorites from the Beatles, NRBQ, Sheryl Crow, Counting Crows, Paul Westerberg, T-Rex, The Muckrakers, Kings of Leon, Hermanos Gutierrez, Red House Painters, Joey Ramone, The Cramps, and my interview with actress Anna Camp, famous of Pitch Perfect. Again, that's just an example of what you can hear every weeknight, 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on any of the social media sites. My address is always the same, at Kyle Meredith, wherever you're looking. And I do hope you like and subscribe. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
By the way, love your back wall.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always-on-the-verge-of-death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan, additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.